Welcome to the Disability and Industrial Society podcast. My name is Mike Manton, and I'm here with George Brinley Evans. George, thank you so much for joining us. If you'd like to say a little bit about where you grew up and which colliery you worked in.
Well, I was born in Dufferin Castle in 1925, and I worked in Entree No. 3 colliery, but everybody called it Banwyn Colliery. Mm. Yeah, there were, when I signed on in Banwyn Colliery, there were 1,200 men working in Banwyn Colliery.
Now, you met with an accident. How old were you when you had that accident?
1961, so I'd be, what, 34, I think.
And then you went on to have quite a long career afterwards.
Yes, I went to a training centre in Cardiff, in Western Avenue. And my first important job, really, was weighing in the coins for the trainees of the Royal Mint. They were half penny pieces with a sailing boat on the back.
Fantastic. Thank you, George.
Now, I don't know, it must have been in the 1950s. And we had Dr. David Aubrey Thomas. Have you come across that name?
Yes, yeah.
Now, we opened a clinic in our village, you know, where we didn't have to go to... You could have x-rays, you could have heat treatment, everything, without family. Anyway, this particular day, my mother called me and she said, George, John, Dr. Thomas's son-in-law is here and he's very worried. Bronwyn, Dr. Thomas's daughter, is expecting a baby and she's quite ill, but she's been taken into hospital. But the doctor has been called to Entree No. 1 colliery, and he's down there tending to somebody that's injured.
Wow.
So I said, I'll take him down now, because John didn't know nothing about colleries. So I drove him down in the car. I went into the lamp room.
Wow.
And they said, listen now, you can't, don't bother now, the doctor's busy, George. He can't be bothered with you now. WS's leg had been swept under the coal with a cutting machine. I'd taken his leg straight. I said, I don't want him now. I said, I just want you to let him know that Bronwyn is all right. She's in hospital. Because he knew she was ill right over his head. And years after, Dr. Thomas told me exactly what had happened. Now, a coal cutting machine, but you've seen a chainsaw, haven't you?
Yes.
When you think of something much bigger. And the spikes had gone into WS's legs.
Oof.
Taking him in, and they had to turn the power off,
yeah,
crank it out by hand, put the spikes back in the hole that they had made, and he had to have his leg amputated, of course. This is the attitude people had then, see, because Dr. Thomas, he opened the surgery that night, he was still, you know, after being underground all day. In the 30s, if somebody was injured, and not too badly injured, they take him home on the back of an horse. Put him back on a, you know, on a horse's back and take him home.
Yeah.
Or they take him home on a stretcher. But if he was dead, they'd carry him up here. You know, when he was carried down here, they still put his cap over his face.
Yeah.
Not for him to be embarrassed when people go up in it, you know.
Yeah. So they'd sort of walk him through the town.
Right, through the village, yeah. Into and everybody knew everybody.
Yeah. So they'd know pretty quickly who had died.
Yeah, and there was one very comical story they used to say about one chap. They carried him out all the way out from underground and up to his house up the hill in the village there. And when they got to the gate with the house, he rang on, lads. He said, I don't want to upset the missus. And he got off the stretcher and carried him for about a mile.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. So you must have memories of doctors and miners walking through the village, like getting to the hospital or getting to wherever they needed to go.
In one of my books, I write about Ernie Beecham, who lived next door to us. He was 19 years of age when he was killed. And a big, kind, handsome looking boy. His mother, when he went out of the mine. And in them days, the only people that came to see her was the vicar and the minister.
Yeah.
There was no other.
But would the village attend funerals of miners? Would the kind of whole town come together?
Oh, and they were very, most of the men that were miners when I was a young man had been soldiers in the First World War.
Right, yeah.
So they weren't going to a funeral. If anybody had turned up in brown boots, he would have been a talk of the valley.
Really?
You know, they were all dressed smart, bowler hats.
Yeah.
Black shoes.
We've got a few artifacts in the cases, including a mobile ambulance that we found when we were looking at Big Pit.
And St. John's Ambulance was a big, big thing, see?
Mm. So they had a branch in your coalfield?
Oh, yeah, well, we had a proper unit in the village. And Evans and Bevan, the polo, they built, not just ours, he built St. John's Ambulance, all right through the valley.
Okay.
And they used to compete.
Yeah, the competitions.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, great. How did you do?
Well, the one song which was in it was very, very good.
Mm. I imagine it must get pretty competitive with people, taking pride in the...
I can't remember quite, but I think you used to get a shilling a day for carrying an ambulance box. A shilling a day was quite a tiny sum.
On top of your wages?
Oh, yeah. Because, well, if you carried it for 6 days, you had 6 shillings. Well, my mother and father lived in a brand new house built by Evans and Bevan.
Mm.
3 bedrooms, hot and cold water, and a big garden for 12 shillings a week.
Yeah. So you've got that extra income.
It was half the rent of the house.
So was there a bit of a, scrap to get to be the one that carries the ambulance?
You just go and tell the manager you'll carry it, But you had to be a qualified St. John's ambulance man.
Yeah.
To carry it.
How many of your colleagues do you think became qualified in there?
It was quite a big unit, And Evans and Bevan, I could have put it in my pocket and brought it down to show you. In the First World War, all the St. John's Ambulance men had volunteered for the Western Front as stretcher bearers.
Yeah.
Were given free of charge 13 tons of coal a year delivered to their house for 5 years. Yeah. 5 years on the way.
Yeah. Did that ever stop? Did that keep going?
No, we were right through the war, They came back and came to work for Evans and Bevan after that.
Yeah.
Because they volunteered to go to the Western Front, they were given 13 tons of coal a year free, see? A ton delivered every lunar month, a ton of coal was delivered to the house.
And that's as almost a kind of reward.
Well, he thought they were good men for doing it. But we had a very exceptionally good family looking at our valley was run by the Evans and Bevans. In the anthracite fields, the Evans and Bevan family, young people today, who they say special needs.
Yeah.
Now, Bevan, if it was possible to give him a job, he'd give him a job.
Mm.
A simple job.
What kind of job?
Well, the rollers that spin on the floor.
Okay.
Going with a big kettle of oil and just doing that all day and every day.
Yeah.
But they were having a full wage.
Mm. So there wouldn't be any wage cuts?
No. Actually, they wouldn't have to go down and beg some civil servant for money.
Yeah.
They had money of their own.
That's nice. That's a good thing to do.
It is. Dignity. The worst thing that you can put a man in is to make him beg for something.
Yeah, absolutely. So, would it be, say if you were injured, say if you had your leg amputated and you couldn't...
Oh, yeah, they could find you a job, they'd find you a job, the Evans and Bevans. And nobody was ever evicted, they owned all the houses as well.
Okay.
And, like I told you, my mother lived in a house 12 shillings a week. And that was everything, the rates, everything was in that.
Mm.
And there were people, say they had a spinster daughter and she outlived her mum and dad.
Mm. She gets to keep the house.
She'd still keep the house at the low rates. Never turned out.
And say you were injured and on compensation, you'd still keep the house.
Oh, yes.
One of the panels we've got is about rehabilitation.
Do you know anyone that that went through the rehabilitation homes and went to Talagan?
Well, I didn't go to there. I lost an eye, so I went to Cardiff to Western Avenue to be retrained.
Okay.
And as an engineer and storekeeper. Sixteen of us were living in a house. Mrs. McMahon was the landlady, one of the big houses in Cathedral Road, you know. And our rent for full board and lodge was £3.10 a week. And it was good lodge.
Yeah. And that was reasonable. That's pretty reasonable.
It was very good.
I'd quite like a house for £3.10 a week now, but then.
But anyway, because you had breakfast and evening meals, eh?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So you get pretty much taken care of.
Yeah, yeah. And anyway, I wrote a letter. There was something on about where would our money, British money, made. And somebody put, and I knew it wasn't right, so I wrote a letter to say that the first money minted in Wales was in Western Avenue, Cardiff. Because as a trainee engineer and storekeeper, there were blokes there, you know, injured from ironworks, steelworks, everywhere. And they were training them now to work in the new Royal Mint that was still being built.
Yeah.
So my first job then in the morning was to collect a bowl of blanks, blank coins, and we had to go through the procedure of security and all that, sign for them, then take them into the machine shop where these lads have been trained to work in the Royal Mint. And at the end of the shift, I'd go and collect the bowl, the weigh-in, collect them. And you know the old half pennies, you don't remember?
I do know them. I don't remember them, but...
You?
I do know them, yep.
Well, they had a ship on the back.
Okay. Oh, yeah,
on the tails of them. Well, that's what we were making. I'd weigh them, and they'd be packed and sent to the Royal Mint in the Tower of London. That's what it was.
Right.
They'd only brought the dies down for the men to teach. But that's where the first money in Wales was made, on Western Avenue, Cardiff.
By you?
Well, not by me, I used to wait in and out.
Still part of the process. So was everyone else at the factory also, though from the injuries, but were most of them be injured?
Arms
or
off, legs off, you know. Not just from the mining industry, from the steelworks, because there was a lot of steelworks then, wasn't it, in
Port Talbot, Never Vale. Okay. Who organised the factories, and how did you get there?
I don't know. They had this special thing, didn't they? Employed.
Yeah.
My first job was in the hospital service as an air clerical officer, but the money in the civil service was dreadful. I think it was on about £800 a year. So when an engineering company advertised a job, I went there then.
Yeah. Right, so how old would you have been then?
Well, I was 35 when I knocked my head. So I'd be about 37, I suppose.
So how long was it in between you losing your eye and you getting your next job?
Oh, about 2.5 years, I expect.
Yeah.
Because I had quite a very bad infection in the socket.
Okay.
So that's what kept me off. It was that bad that I forget what they call it now, there's a special name, Rigers. I remember they were injecting me and I was having shivering fits, you know, to try to kill the infection.
Okay.
And so it was back and forth like that. And you know what? Because the wire that ripped my eye out was filthy dirty. So. Anyway. Some morbid thing. Anyway, I got on, and then I went to work for engineering companies then, and I landed up with Wimpy, best employer I ever worked.
What were you doing?
Well, I in the cost office, I was then looking after the cost office.
Right. We have I'll show you this, one of the things we've got in the cabinet is B.L. Coombs' original manuscript for these poor hands.
I knew Bert well.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Did you communicate about your writing?
No, well, hardly enough. I wasn't like, my wife used to be the news agent, see?
Okay.
And Bert used to take the writer, magazine, the writer.
Oh, right.
And he was old then, and he was living in a small old inn outside the village. So on days when it was terribly wet, Peg would say, my wife would say, take Mr. Coon's own door. And that's how I got to
go.
And there are years the face aid box. Bert used to carry it.
And it is pretty small and compact.
Mm.
So your mine would have had, how many of these do you think would have been in each mine?
I don't know. Mm. When I knocked my eye out, they just put a patch on my eye, you know, underground like.
Mm.
And I walked out about a mile. And then I went into the bath house, you know, the pit head bath. And the old fella who was there was smoking a pipe. And he didn't put his pipe out, he was looking down. Do, George, he said, how did you go and do this? And I said, I'm going to bath first. So I had a shower with my end out, like he put a patch on my eye and out of my eye. So then I drove down to the doctor's.
So you drove by yourself?
Well, my cousin was with me, and he said, I'll drive, George. But when he got in, I had a Volvo car with a, and the gear lever was on the steering wheel. Oh, George, he said, I can't. Oh, so I jumped in, I'll drive. So down we went, and the doctor was fuming. He said, he get out of the car. He said, there's an ambulance on the way here for you, he said.
I'm not and going you made your own way.
I'm not going anywhere, I said, until I go home to see Peggy. So there were poor little John Gibbons, he's dead now.
Mm.
He went, John, can you drive? Yes, drive this clown home, he said. And then I was taken to Swansea, the old hospital, you see.
Okay, so, yeah.
They sold both my eyes up then, because they'd done whatever they had to the Indian and sold both. And there we are. But by the time I got there, my national health was in full swing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would have been dead.
And if it wasn't for the treatment of them.
Oh, yeah. And this is old Bert. This is Bert. That's not Bert.
That's not Bert, but that's his manuscript there.
Oh, I.
Scribbled over.
I got all this for the university, see.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I was in, see, Alan Richards, and he said to me, can you get, what about Bert's beer, George, do you think? So I went down to see his grandson.
Mm.
And I said, it'll still belong to you, only they want it in the university. Mm. I do. So the following week then, Alan didn't drive, he only drove a motorbike.
Oh.
So I drove Alan down then. And he had all this box, and that's how it landed up in Swansea University.
Oh, well, thank you for that. We've got a lot of use for that.
Oh,
it's been restored. It was almost unusable for a while, but we...
Well, it had been up in the attic. It was dark. It was wet.
Yeah.
It was damp and everything.
Yeah.
It's marvellous.
It's actually been rescued.
Yeah. And if we hadn't gone down, it would never come from there, I don't suppose.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
We're very grateful.
Ah, well, Alan decided, asked me what I asked, and I asked him, happily, the boy, the young man who did it, his photo is with his grandfather up there.
Ah, brilliant.
I think his grandfather got him up in his arms. Oh, I knew Bert well.
Mm, that's fantastic. Mm.
In fact, I wrote a short story about him. The man who stayed away in it. So what's that Illustrated London News about?
Well, we chose this to illustrate the family side of life in the coalfields, and we found this one from 1873 of a miner in a strike.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to be the interior of a collier's cottage.
Oh, and some of the coal owners were dreadful. You take Cresco, and I remember Cresco, look, I'm old enough to remember Cresco.
Mm.
I was about, as you get to go, I was 9 years of age when Cresco happened.
Really?
But I remember reading about it, but now I found out more of the history. All the men that were killed, when their mothers and their wives and their pay, they'd all been cropped up until the time they were killed.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. It sounds like you remember your colliery quite fondly, but there's a lot of others.
Well, you take the worst explosion of the lot, was it?
St. Gennet.
What would he find? £40?
Yeah, yeah. And even Aberfan, like, not dealt with properly.
We never had any. We had nasty accidents. We know you heard of Boyce, what's his name? The singer?
Max Boyce, yeah.
His father was killed in our colony.
Oh, really?
I remember the day, yeah. It was a beautiful, real fine sunny day, and my father said to me, "George, go up and see if Joe David's all right." And I jumped on my push bike now and went up to the car. And I got as far as the Federation shed, and the boy shouted, "George, where are you going?" I went up to see if my brother David's all right. "Your brother David is all right. So we'll clear off," they said. Oh, when you were told in them days to clear off,
you would clear off. We have a section about compensation.
Compensation. It was a strange thing now, even. I remember after I had to go down, I was on compensation now. And then I was sent for, like you do, every often they examine you, don't they? And I went down. And I don't know, did this doctor have a little thing against coal miners or what? But I had the papers as well, and I could see a new creation, and that means you will have an eye. When I sat down, he said to me in a very oity-toity, "Now then," he said, "how much vision have you got in that eye?" And I said in the most pleasant voice I could manage, "It's an artificial eye, doctor." "Go and see the clerk," he said, "and get you a bus fare." When I went about a week or two later, I'd been cropped about 20% of my deal. I had to go to a tribunal. Well, not me. The NUM took me to a tribunal. There was about 9 of us there, steel workers and me. I knew QCs. God, they must have cost the earth.
QCs?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then he came to me, George Bernie Evans, and the man from the ministry got up and he said, "Oh, no. Mr. Evans is to have his money back," he said, or whatever.
So afterwards, see, one out in the end.
Afterwards, he came on to me, "I'm sorry about this," he said. "No, you wouldn't." This was about 6 months after. "No, all the money that I hadn't had, I couldn't have. Oh. I'd only be paid from then."
Oh. Did you go to the union? Did the Fed do anything?
Oh, well, no. That was it. That was the settlement. You know, it's always there's always been that little, not normal. It's just one person likes to show their authority.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get it now, don't you?
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
and there's not much you can do about it. But in general, I was treated very good, very well.
That's excellent. How many doctors did you have to go through when you applied for compensation?
Only my own doctor, and then you had to go to the compensation doctor. Well, then I had my eye out, and of course I had this terrible infection. I couldn't be fitted with a glass eye for ages because of the infection in the socket. See?
And were you on compensation that time?
Yeah.
Before you went back.
So, and mind, there's a big difference because in the olden days, they used to have nothing, did they? The only time was when they cropped me that money. And that was only for about 6 months. Like.
Yeah. The rest of it was pretty decent dealings.
Yeah, well, the NUM stood in for me then.
Oh, good.
And they got me back.
Yeah.
And,
did you go through your local kind of lodge compensation department?
Yeah. But now, mind, the one thing that I noticed about the NUM, which I find, I went to Wimpy, I told you. And I was, now everybody, people used to say, if they know you belong to a trade union, they'll sack you. Well, everybody knew that I belonged to the NUM.
Yeah.
Even the directors, because I used to take my work to him every Thursday for the bowlers.
Yeah.
And now when I retired, they send me a keep in touch letter every year. Is there anything you want for? Now, the only thing I feel about the NUM that I find is lacking, that maybe they haven't got the money. Now, I know people like Jeff Camden to work like a dog all his life. Nobody ever went near him, and he didn't have a family. And he was a good union member.
Yeah.
Always paid his whack. Very rare lost a shift. But and it was either all. His wife had dementia.
Yeah.
And either all was a communist.
Mm.
But he believed in communism, see? He used to work from gong to gong. He never used to stop.
Yeah.
And his wife had dementia. And but nobody ever came to help him.
Yeah.
Because he used to walk down to see his daughter, and he'd always come in the garden to have a chat with me, you know. And he was a big fella like you, you know, he wasn't a... And, but he never used to... And he never grumbled about nobody ever coming to see him, eh?
No.
I knew from the way he was talking that nobody was going to see him.
Yeah.
And, you know, as opposed to Winfield. You know,
where you were treated quite, you know, as a, you know, as a member of the family.
Oh yeah, yeah. And that's where I retired.
Sounds like a good last, you know, a last working place.
Yeah.
Sounds very positive.
Yeah. And I had written a few, just that one thing, and that George would ever voice a voice. And I went to the Dem. And then I landed up having three books for myself. Because he told me, what do you see in this class? They used to give him all books to read, you know, and following week they criticised him. See?
Mm.
So he told me, hey, he said, you didn't tell me you'd been published. I said, oh, I only one short, never mind a bugger. He said, oh, I said, don't, listen though, I said, I couldn't stand these criticising me. But he copied it out, and thankfully they all liked it.
When did you first get interested in writing stories?
When I knocked my eye out. I never had time to watch television before. I was all my parents. And Peg said, George, you're spoiling it for everybody else. And if you think you can do any better, try writing something.
Mm.
So I wrote this thing in longhand. And Peg had a niece to come up, Carol taped it, and I wouldn't send it away, see, you know, I thought, oh, I want nobody telling me what a load of rubbish this is, you know. So after a couple of months, Peggy gave me a letter from the BBC. She said, look, here's a letter for you. And it was from a man called Harry Green, who was a very famous scriptwriter. He used to do Zedcars.
Yeah.
You remember Zedcars?
I do know it. The reason I know it is because my dad's an Everton fan, and that's the theme of Everton. The theme from Zedcars.
Well, it was Zedcars and Dr. Finney's casebook.
Yeah.
So he wrote in the letter, he said, will you please come up to London? So I went up. And I met, I'd never been in such a big building before in my life. It was the new BBC building, you know, the one with the round front.
Yeah, yeah, Broadcasting House.
And I met the cast of this. And anyway, George said, and see, the story I had written a drama about underground.
Mm.
And television then was in black and white. Now, how sick can you get?
Yeah.
So he said, George, this is the best thing we've had for ages and ages. Take it home and put it between two cardboard covers. So I went home now and I thought, and of course I had to show Dr. Thomas because he had arranged for, what's his name, a friend who was a filmmaker to meet me in London because I still didn't have an eye, just had a patch of my eye.
Mm.
And Anyway, oh no, no, we'll have to have a second opinion, George, he said. We'll send it off to ITV, and they've just started there. Sent it off, and I had a letter then from Kitty Black, the head of drama for it. Would you come to London, George? She was in South Africa.
Oh.
So that's why we went. And they used to broadcast things later then.
Mm.
There was a play in the afternoon called Boyd QC. So I went into the control room with Erna, watching Boyd QC, and quite a famous British actor was the leading part, I forget his name now. And we're using worse language than it was underground.
Yeah.
The actors couldn't hear it, right? Only inside this room. And when we came out, she said, listen, old George, if you come up to London and work here in the studios, you'll understand what a camera can and can't do. Cameras weren't that sophisticated. And when I was going home in the train, I thought, good God, there's me sitting here, and Peggy's working her socks off, two little boys, and running a business. So I didn't tell anybody about that, and when Peg went out the following day, I took him up a garden, and I burnt a lot of them.
Oh, wow.
And that's how
it's
I
just
landed,
too much, I guess. Yeah.
That's how I landed up in Cardiff, in the training centre. I went up to see the doctor, and I said, you can't get me in. And when George got this infection, it's never mind. So anyway, I got into the training centre.
Yeah, that's an incredible week. You must have been exhausted after all that.
You got to be lucky in the room, the right people. Now, Dr. Thomas, he was the main stage. Because he was a brilliant scholar, you know. He had the first in Oxford and God knows what. And it was George, it was Dr. Thomas that knew George Ewart Evans. They'd been in university together, see. And he told George Ewart Evans about my writing. You know, one thing goes to another.
It's a bit of a change.
You know, because as a collier, I didn't know anybody. And then by chance, and then in the end, I met Alan Richards, of course.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you, George.